Every time I hear that song, I think of Vegas Vacation. Nick Papagiorgio. Up next, Nick Redfern joins us as we talk about secret societies. He has got it all cataloged. It's an amazing story. It's an amazing book. And Nick will be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. British ufologist, cryptozoologist Nick Redfern, author of many books on UFOs, cryptozoology, the paranormal, conspiracies as well. Nick writes regularly for many magazines. He's been a contributor of Fate magazine, and he has uncovered thousands of pages of previously classified Royal Air Force, Air Ministry, Ministry of Defense files on UFOs as well. I can talk with him about so many subjects, his latest secret societies. Nick, welcome back to the program.
Hey, George. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, my pleasure. By the way, condolences, tragedy to that situation in London. Oh, my God, that was horrible.
Oh, yeah, that's terrible news. You know, it's, unfortunately, I think the way the world is, it was only a matter of time before London got hit. You know, but that doesn't sort of... didn't take away the, you know, the tragedy of it. And it just sort of demonstrates how difficult it is to, you know, to prevent these things when they just happen out of the blue, you know.
Yeah. Do you think when things like that happen, Nick, this strengthens or weakens these secret societies?
Well, I think it depends on the perspective of, you know, how we deal with it. I think if we, you know, can stand up to it and say, look, you know, we're not going to be intimidated by that or this, then that actually has a negative effect on, you know, the people who are doing this. Of course, if you sort of plunge into a state of fear, then you play into exactly the position they want you in. So I think when anything like this happens, you know, we need to sort of rally round and stand up and make these people realize that, you know, it's we're not going to put up with this and we're not going to be intimidated by it.
Well, absolutely. Now tell me a little bit of how you got involved in investigating secret societies, Nick.
Well, I guess more than anything else, it was a case of, you know, people contacting me about their experiences and with, you know, a number of different organizations and groups that cover everything from sort of politics to ufology and the occult and all sorts of different things. And so over time, I had a lot of, you know, stories and different data in hand. And then I happened to mention this one of the days to the publisher of the book. And because I'd done a few books previously with them, they said, well, why don't you, would you be interested in doing a book that sort of covers all the various ones that you've looked into? So, you know, that's basically the theme of the book. It's a 400-page long book with 200 entries on all sorts of different secret societies throughout history and throughout the world.
And your publisher is in my old neck of the woods in a suburb of Detroit.
That's right, yeah.
And that's they're doing well. So
yeah.
And did you find? And they came to you. What got them interested in secret societies? Because most publishers would run away.
Well, they've actually done a number of books in the past. Visible Ink Press is the publisher. They've done a number of books in the past that sort of cover historical mysteries and things like that. So I guess, although it's not the sort of thing for all publishers, you know, when they have sort of, you know, published books on, you know, cover areas, you know, like the Masons and things like that, then it was, I guess it was sort of the kind of territory that they liked, you know, and I think, you know, the fact that they realized that I'd got a, you know, a huge amount of material on a lot of obscure cults and secret societies, that's what they like. You know, they didn't want a book that was just going to rehash, you know, the same old stories over and over again. So I think that was, you know, sort of one of the things that kind of attracted them to it.
When you hear the phrase secret societies, what does that mean to you?
Well, actually, that's a good question because, you know, it's sort of a catch-all term that can cover everything from, you know, sort of an ancient, archaic organization, right up to some sort of, you know, modern day body. And, you know, secret societies exist for all sorts of different reasons. You know, I point out in the book, there are, in the past, there were secret societies of assassins, you know, hired assassins. You have secret societies that engage in, you know, sort of ritualistic activities. You have sacrificial secret societies, and you have them within governments, you know, not known agencies, but sort of almost like a small government within the government, you know, where almost like a shadow government as they become known. So secret societies really is a term that you can apply to a lot of different type of, not just groups, but different scenarios as to how and why they exist and their membership and so on.
We'll go through a list of these societies, just a few of them that you outlined in the book, Secret Societies. Was there a secret society during the even the time of Jesus?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can go back, you know, throughout the earliest years of history and find accounts, you know, of secret societies. I mean, a classic example, you know, if you're talking about sort of, you know, the biblical era and prior to that, I mean, would be sort of ancient Egypt, you know, which was filled with secret societies and various orders, particularly, you know, like magicians and things like that. And also within Egypt, ancient Egypt, Egyptian culture, you know, they had like a cult of assassins as well, and, you know, who would do the dirty work for the pharaohs and things like that. So, you know, it's one of these things that I think is what we can demonstrate by looking at some of these ancient stories, is that it shows how human nature hasn't really changed that much. It's almost as if we sort of gravitate towards the idea of a secret society, or a lot of people do. I think it's sort of like a power trip, you know, the idea of sort of being tied to a secret order with a lot of strands and connections and power. And inevitably, you know, as I said, if people gravitate towards that and more people get involved, then the more the group begins to flourish.
Well, there's no question about that, Nick. So let's get into some specifics of some of these secret societies. Sure. Tell us who they are, what they are. Let's begin with the Aerial Phenomena Inquiry Network. What is that?
Well, that's a strange one. This actually surfaced out of the UK in the early to mid-1970s, and actually ties in with the UFO subject. Now, what happened was that in the early 1970s in the UK, there was sort of a fairly large network of UFO researchers, but something very weird happened. It began in 1973, where various UFO researchers in the UK began to receive strange letters through the mail. They were anonymous, there was no return address, and some of them contained old cassette tapes. And a number of them played, for example, when the people played these cassettes, wondering what on earth they were, you know, they're expecting maybe, you know, a message or a story from somebody who had a UFO encounter, but that wasn't the case. It turned out that these cassettes played like a lot of music that the Nazis used in the Second World War, you know, to sort of create this air of like a superior so-called master race, you know, and Adolf Hitler was someone who rallied the people behind him by, you know, playing all this particular type of music and so on. And it turns out that this particular group, the Aerial Phenomena Inquiry Network, they presented themselves as like a UFO research group, but one that was hiding very much in the shadows. But it turns out, as researchers began to look into them, what it actually was like a very sinister, ultra-right-wing organization that wanted to get its strands into ufology. essentially to, if you like, pick people and focus on certain people who then they could sort of nurture and bring into this sort of extremist right-wing fold. So in other words, they were using the UFO subject as a guise to recruit people to their sort of fascist agenda. And the more that people looked into it, and even the British police force got involved as well, the more they looked into it, they found this extremely powerful, dangerous, ultra-right-wing group within the UK that had strands throughout the country. And over the years, they'd been recruiting people from all manner of organisations, the music industry, the arts, in politics. And by the 70s, they started to, as I said, focus on the UFO field. And, you know, a very strange way of recruiting people. But the reason, it seems to be the reason why they did that was to try and carefully cover their tracks. In other words, they took a very alternative way of trying to recruit people. And it seems that over time, their numbers just grew and grew. But it was such a strange network, a strange organization, that no one was able to track them down as to where they lived or how they communicated, etc., etc. And Special Branch, which is an arm of the British police force, they opened extensive files on the organization, and even they couldn't get to the bottom of the mystery of what APEN was and how it operated, other than the fact that it was this incredibly tight network of powerful people who, if you cross them, you could be in big trouble. And some of the people in ufology reported getting death threats and people following them during the day and night, and very sinister story as well.
There is an organization that deals with demonic UFOs called Collins Elite. Mm. What is that?
Well, again, that's a very strange one. And the Collins Elite was a story that I was put onto in 2007 by a man named Ray Beauchet. And Ray has an interesting background. As well as being a priest, he was a former, or he is a former, state director for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. In the 1980s, Ray ran the Nebraska chapter mm-hmm. of MUFON. And in 1991, he was contacted by two representatives of the U.S. Department of Defense. And they said they wanted to speak to him about a program that they were working on, which, you know, is not the sort of call that you get every day. And he had a number of, Ray had a number of sort of lead up, if you like, phone conversations, and they finally met in November 1991 in Lincoln, Nebraska, where Ray lived at the time. And it turns out that they were tied to this particular organization that essentially was looking at the UFO subject from the perspective of it being not extraterrestrial, but literally demonic. And they wanted Ray's perspective purely and simply because he was someone who had a background in religion, but also in ufology with his work as a state director for MUFON. And Ray essentially sort of sat back and listened as they told him about how the group was created and how it was researching these different phenomena. And so the story went, the members of the group, or some of them, attempted to contact, almost in like a remote viewing type way, to try and contact these entities that most people refer to as aliens, but which they concluded were demonic entities. And according to the story, a lot of the people on the program were plagued by bad luck and ill health, and it was like as if a dark cloud, or a curse might be a better term to use, had fallen upon the organization. Now, on the one hand, it sounds a little bit like a, you know, a think tank type organization in the government rather than a secret society.
Right.
But the reason why I include that in the book is because over time they brought numerous people on board to try and figure out what was going on, which included people like demonologists, occultists, even palmists and tarot readers and old people who were well versed in the sort of ancient lore of witchcraft and the occult. And so it turned from being sort of like a think tank within the government to a secret society filled with people from all walks of religion, demonology, the occult, and historical mysteries. And it really did become more of a secret society than it did, as I said, a think tank of government.
At any time, Nick, how many people are part of these kinds of organizations?
Well, that's actually a good question, George, because the reason why so many of these groups aren't just secret but are able to remain secret is because they're sort of very flexible, you know, in the sense that they're not necessarily have a, you know, a specific address, you know, like the headquarters of, you know, the FBI or the CIA. Yeah. It's not like that.
You can't mail them a letter, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. Many of these organizations exist in the shadows, and that's what allows them to maintain their secrecy. And, of course, you know, tracking down a group that doesn't want to be found is extremely difficult. And, of course, when they've got a lot of money, a lot of backing and influence and power, possibly, then that allows them to, you know, essentially exist in a fashion that really puts them on a pedestal, if you like. I don't necessarily mean that from a positive perspective, but it puts them on a pedestal where it's incredibly hard to find a group that's very powerful that doesn't want to be found. And so I think that's why you find so many of these groups within history, you know, would have their meetings in sort of clandestine locations, you know, underground chambers, old houses, things like that, rather than, you know, the places that you might expect, you know, like a static agency or an office. And again, that's one of the things that makes it so hard to track them down. You know, when anyone does want to be tracked down, it's a challenge to find them. So.
What percent of these organizations would you say deal with evil as opposed to goodness?
Well, more than a few, actually. I mean, I talk in the book about a number of organizations that have engaged in a human ritual sacrifice. From their perspective, you know, they believed that by performing sort of rituals like this and human sacrifice, that, you know, it would allow them some degree of power and influence, and, you know, by sort of you know, offering these sacrifices to ancient gods and things like that, which is kind of a surprisingly large number of stories I talk about and that I uncovered, where even in the 20th and 21st century even, these organizations are still sort of, you know, sacrificing and praying, you know, to these ancient earth gods from thousands of years ago. And again, to sort of, you know, to achieve a specific end. And the end is usually power, influence, and money.
Is there some kind of link between these secret societies, Nick, and organizations or things like Men in Black, which you write about in your book?
Well, yes. I mean, the Men in Black mystery is an interesting one because it covers so many areas. Now, you know, if you mention the Men in Black to most people, they think, outside of ufology, I mean, they think, oh, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, you know.
Exactly.
But the real Men in Black are very different. They're very sort of creepy and strange, and, you know, they have these, again, almost like ritualistic type activities. And, you know, they've been tied, obviously, to the UFO subject. But the reason why I talk about the Men in Black in the book is because back in the 15 and 1600s, before, obviously way before the term Men in Black was actually created, a lot of people who were working in the field of alchemy, which is this ancient secret teaching and secret order.
Hold on for a second, Nick. We'll come right back to that story and much more as we talk about secret societies on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Nick Redfern with us. Nick, we were talking about that link between the Men in Black and secret societies and the clock goddess. So let's go back to that. Nick, are you with us? Nope. Let's see if he's here. Nick, you there? Nope, there is no Nick. He is gone. We'll try to get him back as quickly as we can and continue talking about secret societies. Well, there we go again. We can chalk this up to controversy number 62 whenever we're about ready to talk about some kind of secret society or some kind of a strange conspiracy or mystery. They tend to simply just disappear. So we will try to get Nick back on, and here he is. There you go, Nick. The societies are getting you.
There you go.
There you go. But we were talking about the Men in Black and the secret societies, and the clock had gotten us, but I'll let you continue.
Yeah, sure. Well, as I mentioned before the break, you know, most people, you think of the Men in Black, you think of ties to the UFO subject, which is understandable because there are a lot of reports that fall into those categories. But over the years, I've come across a number of other significant and mysterious reports where people have been sort of invited into some of these powerful secret societies and claim to have seen Men in Black type characters at these of these rituals and rites and so on. And the reason why they stand out is because, in unlike the movie versions of the Men in Black, the real versions are very creepy and weird looking. They're very sort of pale and gaunt, and you know, wear these old style suits and the black fedoras. And as strange as it sounds, I've got a number of stories of people who have been sort of invited to join these powerful secret societies and have seen the Men in Black, as I said, hovering around the fringes of these organizations. And some of the people, one of the ones I talk about in the book, where, for example, the person was recruited into this group and then found himself followed by these strange-looking Men in Black for a week or two before he finally got the final invite to join, as if, you know, they were watching him to make sure that you know, he was the right sort of person from their perspective to have on board. And what was interesting is that most of these societies where people talked about seeing these MIB type characters were ones that had a very long ancient lineage going back literally centuries, and a lot of them, I should say, were actually connected with governments and the world of politics and so forth, and it creates like an image of the Men in Black somehow being tied to numerous, not just secret societies, but strands of government as well, as if they've got this almost like an invisible network, if you like.
Are these MIBs, do they look human? Are they human?
No, they actually don't really look fully human. They look very strange. They typically have these large, oversized eyes, which they typically camouflage by wearing sort of large sunglasses that look more like the sort of goggles that a skier would wear, and extremely, probably the best way to describe it is like emaciated. You know, they look like a
gaunt,
sort of reanimated corpse, and this is why people remembered them, you know, so vividly when they were having these initial, you know, interviews, if you like, to see if they were the right people to come on board with these groups. And they would never, the Men in Black would never speak. They would just be sort of hovering and glaring in the background at the people. So very, very weird aspect of the mystery.
Nick Redfern with us. Nick, you write about a lot of people. Who was Kenneth Goff?
Well, Kenneth Goff was someone who, in many respects, was well ahead of his time. Now, there's a great deal of talk within the UFO field and conspiracy theorizing today about the scenario of sort of like a faked alien invasion,
right,
to place us all, you know, under some sort of new world order, you know, but it'll be a ruse, it'll be a fabricated alien invasion, you know, rather than a literal real one, like a false flag but involving flying saucers. Now, as I said, we've heard a lot about that in the last few years. A lot of people don't realize that this man, Kenneth Goff, when I said he was, you know, ahead of his time, it was because Goff was warning about a secret group way back in the 1950s that he believed, or actually he'd uncovered information suggesting way back then they were planning to try and initiate something along those lines. Now, Kenneth Goff was someone who published a massive amount of, or self-published a massive number of dossiers and papers and books. For the titles, for example, Will Russia Invade America? Confessions of Stalin's Agent. And basically, they revolved around politics for the most part. But he actually published one particular paper titled What's Behind the Flying Saucers. Now, this was published in the 1950s, and in this report and in his related writings, Kenneth Gough claimed that as a result of digging into these various secret societies and groups that he believed were sort of the real controllers of the planet, he stumbled upon this group that was taking its inspiration from the famous story of Orson Welles's radio version of War of the Worlds, where people listening to the show who came in halfway through literally thought an alien invasion was actually occurring. And supposedly they took their inspiration from that to think, well, hey, can we actually create a staged alien invasion to essentially take control of the planet? Now, whether or not this could actually be, you know, fully achieved, I guess, is debatable. But the fact that Kenneth Gough uncovered this particular organization in 1950s America, and the more he looked into it, he found that it wasn't, you know, the government that was doing it. It was powerful people who had been recruited outside of government. Some of them, you know, had previous jobs in, you know, in the official world, but on retirement, or in some cases while they were still working, you know, within government, they were recruited into this sort of what we would call like a shadow government, and, you know, told essentially, this is what we want to do. This is our long-term aim, is to sort of enslave the human race. And a number of files have surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act, surveillance files on Kenneth Gough. People were clearly, you know, watching him to see how close he was actually getting, you know, to this mysterious organization. And Gough alluded to having found that the group had recruited people in the UK and Australia and Canada, all of who were sort of willing to get on board with the idea of creating this worldwide ruse of an alien invasion.
Do they try to kill people involved in the UFO field?
Well, you know, this is an area that I cover quite extensively in the book, because, you know, there have been some mysterious deaths in ufology. There's no doubt about that. Now, of course, you know, we're all human. We're all on a time limit. So, you know, a lot of people who die in ufology, you know, they die like the rest of us do, it's old age and things like that. But in saying that, there have been some very weird and sinister deaths in ufology, and this sort of ties in with cults of assassins. You know, we think of assassins, you think of, you know, secret agents, James Bond types. But throughout history, you can find stories of organizations that were sort of loose-knit but extremely secret, where, you know, that they could be hired, and they, you know, they didn't work for any particular agency apart from this sort of very shadowy, carefully hidden group that they were all tied to. Now, I mean, one perfect example of a mysterious death in the very earliest years of ufology was the first Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal.
That's right, yeah.
Who in 1949, one particular night, was either pushed, jumped, or fell, depending on whose version of events you accept as the right one, out of a window, a high window of the Bethesda Naval Hospital. And there are widespread rumors that at the time of his death, he was on the verge of revealing what he knew about the UFO subject. And prior to being admitted to Bethesda, he did have a nervous breakdown. And one of the long-standing theories is that as the first Secretary of Defense, he was informed on exactly what was known about the UFO subject 1947 onwards, and the story is that some of the material was said to be so dangerous and sinister that it essentially plunged him into this sort of like a totally stress-filled state, and then plunged him finally into a complete breakdown. And so the theory is that he was essentially assassinated before he had the ability to tell the public and the media what he knew, which is what he was rumored to be on the verge of doing. Another case I talk about from 1959, a man named Maurice Jessop. Maurice Jessop was a UFO researcher in the 50s, and he was one of the early researchers of the so-called Philadelphia experiment, this old legend.
That's right. That's where his name was
invisible in the end by the Navy in the Second World War. And Maurice Jessop died under very weird circumstances in 1959. He was found in his car, having died from carbon monoxide poisoning in a Florida park early one morning. And it looked initially like a tragic case of suicide. You know, somebody hooks up a hose to the exhaust pipe, puts it through the window, and, you know, within a very short time, they're dead. But it was found there are a number of anomalies with his death. For example, there were a lot of suspicions that the event had been staged, and even the police thought there was something more to this that they weren't able to necessarily resolve. And you can also find a lot of UFO strands around arguably the most famous or infamous assassination of all time, that of President John F. Kennedy. There are rumors that Kennedy was on the verge of revealing what he knew about UFOs when he was assassinated in Dealey Plaza, Dallas in November 1963. You can find numerous people in ufology who were tied to also to the Kennedy assassination. For example, Guy Bannister.
You write about him too, don't you?
Yeah. Well, Guy Bannister was a private detective.
He was with the FBI, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, and he's been tied to the assassination for many, many years. That, you know, he's one of the central figures. It turns out that back in 1947, and we know this through the Freedom of Information Act, that he was heavily involved in investigating the early UFO reports in his official capacity as a special agent back then. Also from 1947, we have a famous story of a UFO exploding over Maury Island in Washington State. One of the primary players in that story was a man named Fred Chrisman. Fred Chrisman, in 1963, after the Kennedy assassination, was actually fingered as one of the three so-called hobos who were photographed just outside Dealey Plaza near some railroad tracks immediately after the Kennedy assassination. And at one point, Jim Garrison, who wrote the book On the Trail of the Assassins, and whose story was told in Oliver Stone's JFK. The story was that Jim Garrison actually thought that Fred Chrisman, this guy who was tied with UFOs back in 1947 at Maury Island, was actually one of the key players and orchestrators of the assassination. And the list just goes on and on. I mean, for example, Lee Harvey Oswald, before he worked at the famous book depository where supposedly he shot Kennedy, he worked for a company called Jaggers Stovers. And the basic work that he did was revolved around analyzing data collected by U-2 spy plane pilots. Now, the U-2 was designed out of Area 51. So, you know, you even have this sort of tie-in with Oswald as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit, too, about the occult and so much more to talk with you about next hour, Nick, and we'll take phone calls as well. The cult of the moon beast, back in 1989, farm animals started showing up dead? What happened here?
Yeah, well, this is in the UK, and, you know, this is one of those, ironically, where a number of these events were occurring was only about 30 miles or so from where I used to live in central England. Now, animals were found dead under very odd circumstances, but we're not talking about like the classic cattle mutilations that we have here in the United States, you know, which seem to be performed by something involved, you know, with high technology, and people talk about black helicopters and UFOs and so on. In the UK, it was very different. this particular organization that was supposedly known as the cult, and still is known as the cult of the moon beast, what was happening was that farmers were finding primarily animals like sheep, dead. You know, the farmers would get up in the morning to feed their animals, and they would find them sort of ritualistically laid out in the fields, sometimes in the shape of stars, and organs were removed, and in what clearly looked like ritualistic fashion, and were laid out in certain patterns on the ground. And the local police got involved, and then it became like a national thing. And these events are still going on. For example, in the English county of Devon in 2005 and 2007, there were a spate of findings of dead sheep in and around ancient stone circles in the area. Devon is a very ancient county with a lot of history attached to it. And again, this particular organization, the Cult of the Moon Beast, was filled reportedly with people connected to British politics and pre-existing secret societies. And essentially, it was a case of, as so many of these secret societies are, it was a case of sacrificial rites performed to specific ancient teachings to try and achieve a specific goal. And that particular goal typically was power, money, influence. Mm-hmm. And
it's like the movie Eyes Wide Shut, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very... very good way of looking at it, is something along those lines, you know, where people are nurtured and recruited into the group, and then they're brought in and they're recruited to perform the same rituals as the people who came before them. But I interviewed a number of people who got very close to this group, the Cult of the Moon Beast, and most of them were very reluctant to talk to me on the record, or even hardly at all, mainly for fear of backlash from these organizations. And again, that was sort of not unlike the Eyes Wide Shut scenario, yeah, you know, yeah, when you have Tom Cruise's character being followed, you know, and watched and so on. And this is what these people found, you know, they would go out of their way, the group would go out of its way to let the people know they were being watched. You know, it was a case of, hey, you talk about us, we know where you live, that kind of thing.
Are these groups put together, Nick, primarily by people who are just so wealthy and so bored they have nothing else to do?
Well, you know, that could be part of it, you know, initially, that it becomes sort of a, I guess it's like a power trip or a thrill for them to know that
they can do this.
A secret order that the rest of us aren't in. But then it becomes more serious when, you know, the power of the group actually crosses over into an area where they then are actually able to impact upon society and begin to manipulate us and control us. So what perhaps in some cases does begin as a little bit of an adventure for them, if you like, mutates into something far more than that.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment with Nick Redfern, Secret Societies. We're going to take your phone calls as well. These societies go way, way back, and just how many are there out there today, for example, functioning? And there's so many stories in his book, Secret Societies. We've just touched on a few.